And welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up on the show tomorrow, our series of conversations with the candidates continues with former Delegate Neil Parrott. He's a Republican running in the primary for Congress in the 6th District. He's been that party's nominee twice before, and this year, the general election race in the 6th is expected to be one of the most competitive in the country. Delegate Neil Parrott will talk about his vision for Western Maryland tomorrow on Midday. And now it's the Midday Health Watch with Dr. Lena Wen. Regular listeners to our show know that Dr. Wen is one of America's most trusted and knowledgeable public health experts. We are proud and grateful that she has been a regular guest on our show for many years. She's a former health commissioner of Baltimore. She's a columnist on health matters for the Washington Post, a medical expert at CNN, and a scholar at George Washington University and the Brookings Institution. Dr. Wen has written recent columns for the Post and CNN about subjects ranging from vaccine misinformation to research on long COVID and nutrition, chronic fatigue syndrome, and how to manage high blood pressure. So we'll take your calls and comments about the health issues that are on your mind. Our number here at Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org. Lena, welcome back. Always a pleasure.
Thank you so much, Tom. Great to join you as always.
So you wrote about a new study, a big study about long COVID. This is a question we get virtually every time you appear on the show. What are we learning about this condition?
Yeah, so there was an important new study. I will clarify and say that it wasn't exactly a big study in the sense that it's not that there were many participants in the study, but rather that it was a really extensive study that examined individuals over a period of time and many facets of their physiology. And specifically, it looked at individuals with a diagnosis called MECFS, which is myalgic encephalitis chronic fatigue syndrome. This is a condition that affects more than 1 in 100 American adults, and yet is something that we rarely talk about. And actually, when we think about and when we do discuss the symptoms of this condition, it's eerily similar to long COVID, as in it tends to afflict individuals who were generally healthy. They have some type of viral or bacterial illness. Not always is it diagnosed even at the time. It could be severe, but it may also be mild. And then subsequently, they experience a number of mysterious effects, the most pronounced of which is this extraordinary fatigue, such that people report they can barely get out of bed. They get fatigued just trying to read a book. And these are people who are very high functioning before, who can no longer work as a result of this. Of course, this is also a very severe form of long COVID as we know it. But specifically, the study by the National Institutes of Health, it examined these patients with MECFS. And they found three things that I thought really stood out. The first is they found clear evidence of physiological abnormalities in these patients. They had immunological disturbances. They had spinal fluid that had different levels of substances called catecholamines, for example. And I think it's really important because many of these patients, including, I would say, long COVID patients, might be dismissed by medical professionals saying, well, maybe this is all in your head, or your deconditioning is because you're tired. There's nothing that's at the root of this. Well, actually, this shows that there is something at the root of it, too. The second thing was the researchers found that the abnormalities were what they call functional, but not structural. So for instance, in the brain, there were no masses or lesions, but there was an area of the brain that had lower activity compared to healthy people. And so this finding actually is good news because structural issues might be less easy to reverse, but functional issues might be reversible and treatable. Of course, we have to figure out what that treatment is, but at least there's hope that that treatment might exist. And then the third thing that I'll mention quickly is that the investigators found differences between men and women. And in a way, this is not surprising because women are more likely than men to have CFS. They're more likely to have autoimmune disease. But I think this pointed researchers to the idea that, well, there might be a spectrum of illnesses associated with ME/CFS and with long COVID. And so what works for one group may not work for another. And so I think that also points to trying a variety of treatments that may help different subgroups with these disorders.
And this is a study that came out of the National Institutes of Health, and you interviewed the lead author of this study, a scholar named Avindra Nath, let me ask you about the first finding that you thought was very important, and that you said that the research showed clear evidence of physiological abnormalities. So what kinds of physiological abnormalities are we talking about? What kind of immunological differences are there for people suffering from chronic fatigue syndrome and other people?
Yeah, so it's really interesting. I was not aware of this, or at least I was not so aware of this. I had heard about it in connection to COVID, that one of the theories for why there is long COVID, why some people experience long COVID but not others, is that when somebody normally comes down with an infection, their immune system is working really hard to get rid of that infection. And then when that infection is gone, the immune system comes down and goes back to normal. But the thinking behind patients with long COVID and also in patients with ME/CFS is that the pieces of that foreign agent, the virus, for example, somehow lingers in the body, or there may be fragments of the virus that lingers in the body. And then it continues to stimulate the immune system even after the infection has resolved. And so that's why these patients may have these symptoms of always feeling like they have the flu. I mean, think about the last time you had the flu. Probably you didn't feel that great. You were really tired. You couldn't get out of bed. Now imagine if you felt like that all the time, except you actually don't have the flu. It's just that your body is tricked into thinking that you have it. Well, those are the types of immunological abnormalities that were found in patients with ME/CFS. And researchers more and more, including Dr. Nath that I interviewed, thought that this term of post-infectious syndromes might encapsulate individuals with long COVID, as in long COVID and ME/CFS may be very similar or even the same entity. And also we know that there may be some other triggers, for example, Lyme disease or Epstein-Barr virus. There are some other things that could trigger this kind of post-infectious syndrome. But again, maybe there is some good news here in that if this theory is correct, that there's some kind of abnormal immune activation, then you could imagine that there might be some treatments that target specific parts of the immune system. And maybe some of these agents already exist because we already have some treatments for autoimmune diseases. And so maybe these could be tried for individuals suffering from long COVID, suffering from ME/CFS. And in fact, part of the reason why I found this NIH study to be worthy of reporting on and commenting on is the researchers made it very clear at the outset of the study that they wanted all the data to be publicly available. They wanted every single piece of data to be published and made available to any researcher worldwide who wants to study this, which I think is really commendable and hopefully can expedite the advances for treatments that these patients really desperately need.
Yeah, that really is commendable. And, you know, obviously sunlight is the best disinfectant for a lot of things, you know, metaphorically speaking, in that the more people know about it. But it is, you know, this is a condition. I know I have some friends just anecdotally who've suffered from myalgic encephalitis or chronic fatigue, and it's really devastating. And it's not an insignificant number of people who are dealing with long COVID as well as chronic fatigue syndrome. So this does present all of those patients some hope. We have a couple of COVID questions. Let's start with Deb, who's on the line in Baltimore. Welcome to the Midday Health Watch with Dr. Nguyen.
Hi, thank you. I was wondering if there's any validity to the theory of people who have certain blood types being more prone to getting COVID. I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Yeah, we've heard about this. You know, if you're type A or if you're type O or something, if you're a certain blood type, you're either less inclined or more inclined to contract COVID-19. What do you think?
Well, it turns out to be true, as in there are now several studies that have shown that people with the blood type O, that they are less susceptible to contracting COVID versus those who have blood type A are more likely to have it. And they believe that that it's because of the way that COVID interacts with blood cells, and that the part of the spike protein is more effectively binding to the group A cells than they would bind to group O cells. And so this actually does turn out to have some scientific validity. Although, of course, I will just warn individuals that even if you're blood type O, you could still get COVID. And of course, if you have blood type A, even if you're more likely to contract COVID, That doesn't mean that you're somehow doomed to suffer severe illness from it. And of course, that there are things that we can do to reduce our chance of severe illness. For example, being up to date with our vaccines, and also for those eligible, making sure that we take Paxlovid or other antiviral treatment.
And speaking of Paxlovid, we have a listener with a question about that. That's the antiviral drug that you take if you do contract COVID. It doesn't prevent it, but it lessens the symptoms and shortens the duration of the disease in most cases. Maxine is on the line with a question about that. Welcome to the show with Dr. Nguyen.
Thank you very much. Well, I had COVID twice. I took Paxlovid the first time. I didn't take it the second because I had read that it may cause some, I don't know, repercussions later. I'm 86 years old in good health. So, your thoughts?
I would highly recommend that if you were to contract COVID again, that you take Paxlovid. And that's because age is a major risk factor for having severe illness due to COVID. You are probably slightly better protected in with repeat infections, as in the immunity that you built up from prior infections probably shields you a bit from having more severe illness. However, you're still at risk for severe illness because of age. Paxlovid is very effective at reducing your likelihood of hospitalization or death because of COVID. Now, like every medication, there are side effects associated with Paxlovid. The most common side effects are things like metallic taste in your mouth. Some people also may get some minor stomach upset and some diarrhea associated with it. There was some question earlier about whether there is an increase in rebound symptoms, as in you start feeling better, but then you then develop the COVID-like symptoms again after taking Paxlovid. There were, though, some studies, including an analysis by the Food and Drug Administration, by the FDA, that found that there was no more likelihood of rebound for people who take Paxlovid compared to people who don't. And so I think the jury is still out on whether you're more likely to have this recurrence of symptoms with taking Paxlovid. But I would say, even a recurrence of symptoms of, I would rather have, and I think most people would rather have, two times of mild symptoms rather than one time of really severe symptoms that could put you in the hospital. So again, I would recommend that if you or others in your similar situation were to contract COVID again, that you would take Paxlovid, or if you're not eligible for Paxlovid, another antiviral treatment.
It's the Midday Health Watch with Dr. Lena Nguyen, former Baltimore City Health Commissioner and a columnist for the Washington Post. If you have a question for Dr. Nguyen, 410-662-8780. Our email is midday@wipr.org. And I'm Tom Hall. So, Lena, Linnell and I, my wife, got our COVID booster shots this weekend. And we were happy to do that. It had been about 5 months since we'd had our last booster shot back in October. You do recommend that folks, particularly in a certain age group, get another booster for COVID-19, even though we're going into the warmer weather and we're going into a time period during the year that traditionally and over the last several years, incidences of COVID have gone down a little bit. But what's your recommendation for folks when it comes to another booster?
Well, the CDC has recommended that people 65 and above receive the spring booster, if you will, as in if it's been more than 4 or 5 months since their last dose of the COVID shot, that they're able to receive another one now. And of course, here with the booster, I'm referring to the same vaccine formulation as the one that was developed and is out since last fall. And so this is the monovalent vaccine that targets the XBB.1.15 variant, one of the Omicron subvariants. And if you receive that in the fall, and it's now several months since that shot, you're able to receive that now. So again, recommended for people 65 and above. And if you're under that age, but if you are immunocompromised or otherwise have severe underlying medical conditions, you should be eligible as well. I mean, I think that this is it's a good idea. There's really no reason why people who are particularly vulnerable to severe illness shouldn't get this vaccine. One of the questions that I get a lot is, well, if I take this now, what about in the fall? What about when, as you were saying, Tom, when we would expect there to be more COVID activity, and also coming into the winter holidays, what should we do? Almost certainly there is going to be a new vaccine developed this fall. It'll probably be developed this summer, and the formulation will be to best match the variants that are likely to be dominant this fall and this winter. We don't know what those variants are now, but that development is going to happen this summer, and I would expect that another vaccine, a reformulated vaccine, is going to be available this fall in the same way that we have a reformulated flu vaccine every year. But individuals who receive their spring booster now will also be eligible to receive that fall vaccine at that time. So again, I don't see any reason why people who want to get the spring booster should not get it. I think there are a lot of people who want to be as optimally protected as possible. And if that's the case, then I think that's a good idea to do. At the same time, I also don't think that it's essential. We have many people who never even received that fall vaccine. And I think it's far more essential for those people to receive the one shot than for people to get two shots. But thankfully, we don't have to make that choice, as there is really plenty of vaccine to go around.
Yeah, you mentioned in a piece in the Post that it's only 42% of folks 65 and older have gotten the first monovalent shot. So there's plenty of people who haven't even gotten the first booster, nonetheless the second. So people are making decisions, but we're certainly very comfortable with the decision. Linnell and I are comfortable with the decision that we made. We had the same reaction to the vaccine that we've had in the past. We got it at the end of the workday on Friday, and we felt a little tired on Saturday. And by Sunday, Easter Sunday, we were perfectly fine and out and about doing our normal routine. So, everybody needs to make a decision. But there is certainly still an awful lot of vaccine misinformation out there. And in the Post, you wrote a piece about responding to people who present misinformation, who have questions about the COVID vaccine. You spoke with a guy named Sean O'Leary, who specializes in pediatric infectious diseases. He's out in Colorado. And it was very helpful, this piece. You outline a number of things that people may say, and then what you can do to respond to them. But overall, what are the tips that you would suggest to folks if they feel that they are being confronted by a family member or a friend or a colleague when it comes to vaccine misinformation?
Yeah, so I wrote this column because I had a number of readers who wrote with kind of a basic question, which is, look, I really strongly believe in vaccines, and I vaccinated my entire family. I have no hesitation with getting vaccinated myself, but I also have a niece, a neighbor, a friend who is skeptical about vaccines, and I want to have a conversation with them. So how do I do that? And I think that one of the key points, and the reason why I wanted to talk to a pediatrician about this, and Dr. O'Leary specifically, his research is in vaccines and in vaccine communication. I wanted to talk to him because pediatricians address these concerns about vaccines all the time. And one key is to make sure that you respect the other person and are understanding that the other person is coming to you not to be combative generally, but rather because they have questions. And I think starting with that basis of respect is really important. And so I think it also, he said, and I believe this is true too, that it's also helpful to share personal stories. So many people in younger generations, for example, did not live through the era where we might remember what it's like to be fearful of polio or to be fearful of measles. But there are plenty of people who did live through those eras. And so sharing those stories might also help other individuals understand why we have these vaccines, because the diseases that we're seeking to prevent are so terrible. And otherwise, my column laid out the 10 kind of common things that you might hear about. For example, the idea that natural immunity and just getting the disease is better than vaccination, or the idea that, well, I don't need to vaccinate my kids because the chance of contracting the disease is so low. I think there are ways to respond to these concerns such that you're hearing the concern and that you're responding to that specific concern while also bringing in your personal experience and as it relates the relevant data.
Yeah, for example, Dr. O'Leary says that, you know, one of the reasons the chance of contracting the disease is lower is because we vaccinate, because people have gotten the vaccine. When it comes to natural immunity, Dr. O'Leary says, you know, holding the belief that natural immunity is better than immunity you get from vaccination, that's not necessarily true, is it?
Well, I think the main issue here is that if you want natural immunity, that means that you have to get the disease. And these are not diseases that we want to get. Many of the diseases are incredibly severe, and maybe you'll get lucky, you'll get a mild form of the disease, and then you'll have natural immunity. But you may also get extremely ill and may suffer permanent effects because of it, as opposed to getting the vaccine, where you could get that high level of protection, of immune protection, but without the risk of becoming severely ill. And I think here's where it's important to get into the detail of the rigorous testing that the vaccines go through. Vaccines are held to a much higher safety standard compared to other medicines because they're used to prevent diseases rather than to treat them. And so when we treat diseases, we tolerate some side effects. But because with vaccines, they're being used in healthy people who don't have an illness, there are really stringent safety standards. They go through many levels of approval through the FDA, through the CDC. And then post-approval, there's also a robust safety surveillance system to look for rare side effects. Or when there are rare side effects reported, there are also very careful studies to see, are these side effects just what they're going to happen in the population? Or is there some kind of causality or association there? And so I think for people to understand the extraordinary care that these that federal health officials go through, that scientists use in tracking these vaccines, I think is also helpful, because maybe not everybody is aware of these extraordinary steps and therefore how certain we are about the safety of these vaccines. And here we're talking about routine childhood immunizations, many of which have been around for decades, and many millions of people have taken here in the U.S. and worldwide.
Yeah, and you write specifically about measles in particular. You just mentioned that. You know, this is a normal vaccine that kids have been getting as a prerequisite for being able to attend school in many school districts. For years and years, we have several questions from listeners on email about measles. Leslie, self-described as a boomer, says, if we had measles as kids, is our immunity still good, or should we get a booster vaccine for measles?
If you had measles when you were a child, you have presumed lifelong immunity, and you do not need to get another shot for it.
And then Claudia says, when I was a child, I had something called German measles as well as regular measles, and I never hear about German measles anymore. What's the difference?
Yeah, German measles is also known as rubella. So that is another type of a virus. And so the MMR vaccine is the measles, mumps, and rubella vaccine. And so the MMR vaccine would cover for rubella, which is German measles, as well as for measles.
And let's go back to the phones. Bianca is on the line in Baltimore. Bianca, welcome to the Midday Health Watch with Dr. Nguyen.
Thank you for taking my call. Dr. Nguyen, we trust you. Thank you for your work. My question relates to recurring sinus infections after COVID. Can you speak to that?
That's interesting. I have not specifically heard of recurrent sinus infections in connection to COVID, although it is something that we would see with other viral illnesses as well, that people who, after other viruses, may have different issues that come up, including more inflammation in the respiratory tract that may manifest as sinusitis, or that may manifest as continued coughing and such. It may be worth it to explore whether there may be a structural issue. And so I would recommend that you contact your physician. Maybe there is something else that's there, as in maybe you have allergies that need to be treated, and that is what's causing the sinus problems. Or maybe you have a structural issue in your nose that may be fixable, that may be triggering this as well. So it may be related to COVID. Yeah, but it's all, there's also the possibility that it may not be. And so I think getting to the root of that may help you feel better.
Yeah, and I've read that allergy season has been extended by about a month. It's longer having to do with climate change now than it was 5 or 10 years ago by a factor of about 30 days. So for folks who suffer from allergies, of course that those are different things than sinus infections, but there are a lot of people with sniffles these days having to do with what's in the air. We're going to take a quick break. It's the Midday Health Watch with Dr. Lena Wen. She's a former Baltimore City Health Commissioner and the author of a wonderful book called Lifelines, A Doctor's Journey in the Fight for Public Health. She's a columnist for the Washington Post, as well as a medical expert on CNN. Dr. Wen will be with us until the top of the hour, and you are welcome to join us. 410-662-8780. If you have a question or a comment, our email midday at WIPR.org. And before we go to a break, each week here on Midday, it's our practice to read the names of people who have lost their lives to violence in Baltimore City and to list their names on the Midday webpage. We get their names from a researcher named Ellen Worthing, from the Baltimore Sun, and from the Baltimore Police Department. We do this to stand in witness to their untimely deaths and to remember their families and friends in their hour of grief. So far this year, 48 people have been identified as victims of homicide in Baltimore. One person was killed in Baltimore last week. He has not yet been identified publicly. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. We'll be right back.
This is 88.1 WIPR, Baltimore's NPR news station.
And welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. If you've just joined us, it's the Midday Health Watch with Dr. Lena Wen. Dr. Wen is a former health commissioner of Baltimore and a columnist for the Washington Post. She's the author of two books, including Lifelines, A Doctor's Journey in the Fight for Public Health. Our number, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday at WIPR.org. And Lena, as is usually the case when you're on the show, we got lots of emails, lots of calls. We'll try to get to them. Here's one from Lauren, an email who says, please ask why the COVID virus is surging again now while the weather is getting warmer and therefore people are seemingly going outside more often. So is the COVID virus surging as we speak now? I mean, how does it compare to, you know, 4 months ago to January or late December?
I mean, I think a lot of it is going to depend on the part of the country. Overall, I just looked at the CDC statistics this morning and the cases don't appear to be surging. I mean, it's possible that maybe in a particular part of the country that this listener is referencing, maybe they're increasing, but overall, they do not seem to be. I would say in general that unlike for other viruses that we know of, for example, influenza or RSV, where there is a very clear seasonal pattern, the seasonality for the coronavirus, for this coronavirus, has not yet been established. So far, we're seeing multiple peaks in a year. We're not seeing that there's just this winter peak as there is usually for influenza and for RSV. Right now, it looks like there may be two or three peaks over the course of the year. So that part has not really been fleshed out. But there are some scientists who believe that over time, there may be a more clear seasonal pattern involved. But right now, in most places around the country, coronavirus is not surging. But that doesn't mean that we can't have a peak this summer. And certainly I would anticipate that there would be a peak this fall and winter.
And of course, we are getting into that time of year where when the rain stops, and it will stop, we're told, sometime in our lifetime. Although it seems sometimes like it'll never stop, but it's going to be with us for another few days. But, you know, people will be able to open their windows and stuff, and that's all going to help as well. Let's go to Susan, who's on the phone in Frederick. Welcome to the show with Dr. Nguyen.
Hi, yes, thank you. I'm 61 and in good health, and I've had all the routine COVID shots and boosters and have never contracted COVID. And you said for those 65 plus, you advise getting the booster. Should I consider getting the booster as well, or is that overkill and silly since I'll be attending some large events this spring?
Okay, age 61. What do you think, Dr. Nguyen?
I think that there are other ways to reduce your risk of becoming severely ill if you were to contract COVID. Certainly, if you're 65 and above, again, the recommendation from the CDC is that you do receive that spring booster. But for people who are generally healthy, who are not 65, that is not the recommendation. And so I would hesitate to say that that's something that the listener should do. But that individual could consider, should certainly speak to their doctor about having access to Paxlovid if they were to contract COVID. And I think also evaluating any other risk factors in your life. So what other medical issues do you have, et cetera, that may make you higher risk. But just based on age alone, that would not be the recommendation to receive the spring booster at this time.
All right. Thanks for that call, Susan. And you mentioned, again, Paxlovid. Lena, we have an email from Marge, a listener who says, what are other things that can be taken if you're on medication that precludes Paxlovid? Are there things that you can get in advance and have on hand? This is a question that we often get because there are some people who, because of whatever the other stuff that they're taking, can't take Paxlovid. What do you recommend in that case?
Well, the first thing I would say is make sure that you really cannot take Paxlovid, because Paxlovid is by far the most convenient therapy that is also the most effective. So there are other alternatives. There is the remdesivir infusion that can also be given as an injection. But in any case, it's either an IV infusion that you have to go somewhere to get an infusion, or it's given as an injection and it's pretty difficult to obtain. Then there's also molnupiravir, which is a pill similar to Paxlovid, but it's less effective than Paxlovid. So those are, to me, they're lesser options, and they should be taken if you have no other options, if you really cannot take Paxlovid. But what I've found is that many patients are being told they cannot have Paxlovid, but actually they don't have an absolute contraindication. They don't have an absolute reason. So for example, yes, many medications cannot be combined with Paxlovid. But if you're on, for example, certain types of cholesterol medications, they can be stopped for a period of time and then resumed once the Paxlovid has stopped. And so the Paxlovid is taken for 5 days. Not taking your cholesterol medication for 5 days is not really that big of a deal. On the other hand, maybe you're on blood thinners, and it is a big deal. You don't want to stop your blood thinners in order to take Paxlovid. And so I think it's worth a conversation with your physician to find out, is it absolutely that you cannot take Paxlovid, or are there things you could do, including stopping the other medication for a short period of time? Because Paxlovid is still the recommended medication for as antiviral treatment for COVID.
Dr. Lena Nguyen is with us, as she is once a month here on Midday for the Midday Health Watch. I'm Tom Hall. Our number here at Midday, if you have a question for Dr. Nguyen, 410-662-8780, or email midday@wipr.org. So we were talking about chronic fatigue syndrome earlier in the program. We have a question from Carol, who's on the line from Joppatown, about chronic fatigue syndrome. Welcome to the show, Carol. Thanks for calling.
Good morning. I have a question about chronic fatigue syndrome as far as diagnosis and treatment. Are there any definitive tests that can be done that will diagnose for the doctor that you do have chronic fatigue syndrome? And if you do have it, what are the treatments?
Yeah, it's a great question. And at the moment, there is no single diagnostic test for ME/CFS, for myalgic encephalitis chronic fatigue syndrome. The way that it's diagnosed is through a thorough medical exam, through excluding other things That may masquerade as such, but there's no single blood test. There's no single biomarker that helps you to make that diagnosis. That is certainly part of the research that is ongoing and that is really crucial because that'll also help these patients with establishing a diagnosis and then for proceeding accordingly. Right now, there are symptomatic treatments that may help certain individuals, but there is no cure. There's no approved treatment for this illness, which again is something that is that is really essential for researchers to examine. One of the recent columns I wrote was of I interviewed a woman who was diagnosed in her early 50s with ME CFS, and she talked to me about how difficult it was for her to go through this huge period of uncertainty where she knew there was something wrong, but she could not be diagnosed with the issue. She also was so tired that she could barely listen to the TV or radio. She had a large extended family, but she was so fatigued she couldn't even talk to them. And just hearing about the many experimental treatments that these patients are basically forced to go through because there is nothing approved to help them. It's really heartbreaking. And I really sincerely hope that much more attention can focus on studying this. I mean, the NIH is spending about only $13 million a year to study this disease, which is a fraction of the amount that's allocated to studying other comparable illnesses, especially considering that this is a disease that affects more than 1 in 100 American adults.
And again, there's a difference between the COVID vaccine for adults and measles vaccines or rubella vaccines, et cetera, for children. One of the points you raise in your article about measles, for example, is that some people say, well, I'm not going to say no to vaccines forever, but I'm just going to delay them until my child is older and more robust. Is there any reason whatsoever to wait until your kids are older before they start getting their regular schedule of vaccinations?
Not at all. And here is the reason why. And again, I thought it was helpful to talk to a pediatrician who routinely gets these questions. The thing is, most diseases that we vaccinate for cause the most severe illness for kids who are the youngest. This is why the CDC vaccine schedule starts in infancy. Babies start receiving the vaccines. And by waiting, parents would be leaving their children at risk for infections at their time of highest risk, when they are more likely to have the most severe outcomes. And so there is no reason to wait to get vaccines, to get these routine childhood immunizations, which again have been around for many decades and have been some of the most successful public health interventions in the history of mankind.
Edwin is a listener who emails, I have symptoms of pain and loss of strength in the muscles of my legs near my knees. It's very difficult and painful to try to stoop down. May this be a residual symptom of COVID? I had a mild case of COVID at the beginning of March, and I did not take Paxlovid. What do you think?
I am not sure. It would be a very unusual symptom of COVID. Certainly COVID, and especially long COVID, these persistent symptoms can run the gamut. They could run the gamut from continuing respiratory problems to overall fatigue. But this sounds very specific, as in there are certain muscles, it sounds like for this listener, that seem to be weaker in particular. And so I would definitely recommend that he contact his regular physician and get a checkup. Because one of the issues that I've seen and that others have, other clinicians have seen, is sometimes you end up attributing too much to something. And an association is not necessarily causation. And we would not want to miss another diagnosis, as in maybe there is something else that is causing these symptoms that you're seeing. And if you're just attributing it to COVID, you might actually be missing another potentially severe diagnosis. And so I just would not want you to want the listener to think that this is all COVID when it may be something else.
Let's go to Peggy on the phone in Baltimore. Peggy, we have just less than a minute left. What's your quick question for Dr. Nguyen?
So if you've recently had COVID and you're a senior citizen, if you've had COVID within the last 2 weeks, should you, and gotten over it, should you have the spring booster? And if you do, when should you have it? Or how long should it be after being diagnosed clear of COVID?
That's a great question. And because you just had COVID, and I'm glad that you recovered from it, it sounds like very well. If you just had COVID, you are extremely well protected from a repeat infection, and you do not need a booster at this time. I think you could definitely wait at least 3 months, but I think by then you might as well wait for the fall booster, which should be out in September.
Dr. Lena Nguyen joins us every month for the Midday Health Watch. We'll have a link to Dr. Nguyen's columns in the Washington Post on the Midday webpage at WIPR.org. She writes for the Post, she writes for CNN, and she is a great friend of the show. Thanks so much, Lena. As always, appreciate it, and we'll see you in May.
Thank you, Tom.
That's it for us today. And tomorrow, we will continue our series of conversations with the candidates with Neil Parrott. He's a former delegate in the Maryland legislature, and he is once again running for Congress in the 6th District. That's over in Western Maryland. Delegate Parrott will make the case for his candidacy tomorrow here on Midday. And looking ahead to next week, our series of conversations will continue with April Delaney. She's also running in the Democratic primary in the 6th District. Fresh Air is on the way at the top of the hour, so stick around for that. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks so much for being with us. Thanks so much for subscribing to our podcast and checking us out on the WIPR app. We appreciate it. Have a great day.
This is 88.1 WIPR, Baltimore's NPR news station.